Morning, everybody. Our second day of our ASAP meeting. We're going to begin with a very simple subject. Thesis. Henry, you're going to tell us how we should do it.
Well, good morning, everybody. I think this meeting has sort of fortunately has timed itself rather beautifully, I think, because we sort of at the end of the comment letter period was just nearly 2 weeks ago now. We're obviously well into the round table phase, if you like, of getting the feedback. And essentially that is our objective this morning, is really to have a round table with you and get your insights and views on the exposure draft and your advice about how we should move forward. So I should thank you all for your comment letters and your insights. We've received something like nearly 600 comment letters so far, and it's probably and counting. But before we actually get into the sort of the topic areas in the agenda paper three and the discussion, I thought what I'd just like to do is just take a few minutes just to report a little bit on the extensive outreach activities that have been undertaken, fairly extensive activities, whilst the exposure draft has been out for comment since May, earlier in the summer. So, as I said, we've been really out and about doing a lot of outreach activity, and it's really been focused on assessing the cost and benefits of the proposals, because that's very fundamental to the two boards. So obviously in terms of the benefits, we've been very much sort of speaking to the users, and on the cost side of the equation, obviously we've been holding meeting with preparers. And I think this has been a very important part of the feedback that we've been getting. And, you know, as I said, together with the roundtables and the something like the 600 comment letters, there's clearly a lot of information that's going to have to be analysed for the boards to consider before they sort of move into their re-deliberations. And I suspect what this means is that the sort of comment letter sort of summary process will start at the November board meeting. So anyway, so moving to the benefit side here and the views of investors and analysts, a sort of like a more comprehensive summary and probably a far better summary of what I'm just about to say will soon be made available on our website. It should be there very shortly. But just to give you a sense of the scale of the activities, we've had something like 35 meetings with over 220 investors and analysts around the world, and we still have some more of these meetings to come. The focus sort of today has primarily been on the lessee accounting proposals. And I think our overall take from these meetings is that we feel that we have broad support for the lessee accounting proposals in the exposure draft from investors and analysts, particularly for that basic premise of recognising lease assets and liabilities on the balance sheet. And I suppose that's not really perhaps that surprising when you think that almost all that we speak to actually do think that leases create assets and liabilities, and accordingly most of them are making adjustments today for lease obligations. And I think the overall sense is that what we'd be providing with these proposals will provide a more robust starting point for their analysis. But of course, clearly there are different views out there about how to report leases, and I think it's probably fair to say that the views of the equity analysts are perhaps do vary more than the credit analysts. So I think in terms of the equity analysts, there's probably sort of three main views out there. You've got some equity analysts who are very much trying to get to the sort of the contractual commitments, and therefore they're fully supportive of the balance sheet proposals. But you've obviously got equity analysts who are looking just beyond just the risk. They're trying to assess operating performance. And some of those would like more of whole asset information. In other words, they're trying to get at what would be the equivalent whole asset, not just the right of use asset, particularly those analysts that are working in industries or following industries where there's significant lease-buy decisions made, so the transportation sector would be a key one. And then there are equity analysts who are very much focused on the liability side of the proposals, but what they would like to see is more the lease commitments on a sort of ongoing perpetual basis. So they perhaps would want to go beyond just the sort of the contractual commitment approach that we have in the exposure draft. But as I said, overall, the majority of equity analysts sort of support the proposals and think that they will give about the risk and the leverage of the companies that they follow. The credit analysts, I think their views are less diverse than the equity analysts, and they're strong supporters for the balance sheet proposals. They do believe that leases create assets and debt-like obligations, and they think that having the lessee's contractual commitments reported on the balance sheet in a consistent way would be a significant improvement to financial reporting and provide them with much more sort of consistent information and reduce their costs. In terms of the cost side, if you like, of the cost-benefit equation, we've held, obviously, fairly extensive meetings with preparers. And one of the key features of the meetings with preparers has been the on-site fieldwork that we've undertaken with lessees and lessors. And these have really been very much in-depth discussions. We met with a fairly broad array of people at the company's premises. We went beyond the accounting. We met the operations people, the legal, the IT, etc. And those meetings are ongoing. Today we've held about 15 of these sort of field work meetings, and we've got at least 10 more to come over the coming weeks. And they really allowed us to really sort of dig in to the proposals. And in particular, it's allowed us the opportunity to really find out what are the particular aspects of the proposals that are causing sort of concerns about cost and implementation difficulties, instead of just sort of, you know, that a lot of people talk about that the proposals are very costly and complex, but it's really allowed us to sort of actually dig into what are the real drivers there. Like the users, I think there's a general acknowledgement amongst the preparers that leases do give rise to assets and liabilities. The concerns, I think, that have been raised mainly centre around a number of areas. I think some preparers are concerned about the complexity of having a dual model. There's no doubt about that. There's also quite a lot of concern about determining the lease term, and particularly around this threshold of significant economic incentive. There are also concerns about some of the other areas, like separating lease components from non-lease components, about reassessment, particularly of the variable lease payments and the lease term. And also one area where, you know, some industries are particularly affected by this, they're looking for more guidance around the definition of a lease, just to help make that distinction between a service contract and a lease contract. However, the overall message that we're getting from these workshops is that whilst there clearly could and should be some simplifications to the proposals to reduce the cost of implementing them, I think we're getting a real sense that people do feel that the proposals, based on who we've spoken to, obviously, are doable and workable. I think the only other thing I just noticed is that out of those workshops, we've heard very little concern or very little feedback to suggest that the proposals would result in very significant behavioural change. So, you know, there's a lot of commentators asserting that our proposals will lead to very significant changes in lease versus buy decisions, but that's not really what we've heard from the preparers. So anyway, that was a very brief overview, and as I said, I think it may even be this week, but we hope to get a summary of the user feedback onto our website, which you'll be able to look at. So with that, I'd like to turn now back to agenda paper 3 and the topics for discussion this morning. And we have 4 topics for discussion. The first topic is clearly by far the largest of these, and obviously it concerns the basic architecture of the lessee and lessor model. And I think we could easily allow this part of the discussion to run for, you know, at least till 10 o'clock.
Henry, I was just thinking, Russ, would it be a good idea that you give, if you can give some impressions on the feedback that you have received before you tell them?
Sorry, yes.
Unless you're not prepared,
no, that's fine. Most of it has been joined. I would recognize some of the things that Henry talked about, that most of the users do believe that this is a right and obligation approach, and they consider that. We did receive a letter from our investor advisory council that recommended some substantial changes. They do believe this is an asset and liability. They just don't believe we've measured the asset and liability appropriately. And so I think a lot of people out there felt that their conclusion was that they disagree with the concept of asset liabilities here. That's not true. They just don't believe we've measured it appropriately. And they believe we're going to add cost because they'll have to subtract the amount that's reflected and then add what they think is their metric for what the true obligation is.
And they had among themselves consensus about what the metric should be.
No, they do not.
Okay.
Some take last year's rent expense and multiply 7, some 8, some 9. That is designed to depict what is the ongoing lease obligation on a continuous going concern basis, even beyond the actual company's contractual commitments.
Okay. Okay, so if we turn to the first topic first in the paper, as I said, this is that's one of the key areas. Clearly, it's about the architecture of the model, the lessee and the lessor model. And we just put some very brief paragraphs in the paper just to sort of summarize and remind ourselves about the proposals. Just very briefly, for lessees, of course, the boards have maintained the right of use model from the 2010, but in response to the very extensive feedback that we received on that exposure draft, we have obviously introduced this dual approach for the recognition of expenses and cash flows. And of course, that decision wasn't undertaken lightly. We did very extensive outreach during the development of ED to arrive at that dual approach that was included. And of course, the approach is based on this consumption principle, in other words, whether the lessee is expected to consume more than an insignificant amount of the economic benefits in the underlying asset. The boards thought that sort of principle captured an important economic differences between leases. For lessors, that consumption principle determines essentially whether the lessor derecognizes the underlying asset and records in its place the receivable for the lease rentals and the residual asset, or continues to recognize the underlying asset and reports rental income. So we've got four questions after paragraph 11. Maybe we should try to sort of, I don't know whether this will work, but maybe we should try to talk about the lessee aspect first and then turn to lessor, unless you can't sort of divorce the two when you're thinking about your overall comments about the model. The first two questions are really seeking your views as to whether you think sort of leases are economically different and a dual accounting approach results in improved financial reporting that outweighs the costs, and also whether you agree with how we've implemented that dual approach for lessee accounting. So I think I've said way too much now, so hand it over for your views.
Wants to tee off.
Just get rid of the table.
Oh, well. No, I don't agree with the... We don't agree in our submission with the dual approach. We think it does add a good deal of complexity, and I think it... in a sense, disrespects the elements in the income statement, giving for a lessee a very strange amortization of what benefits they do use up. We also don't think the approach works at all well in our environment, where probably half of our constituents revalue property, plant and equipment, not just land and buildings. So, which I think.
Sorry, can you speak up a little bit, Kevin? So half of your constituents
revalue their property, plant, and equipment. In other words, the whole public sector, which you might ignore, but it does bring home the fact that it doesn't work well in that environment, because whenever you revalue the property, plant, and equipment, you're not going to get a zero-sum game over the life of the lease, because the amortization will exceed the liability over time. So you provide an out in the document for property lease, well, for those ones in which revaluations happen, but it seems to me that you're assuming that that'll be land and buildings. And it's not in our case. That, and I think some of the sub-tenant situations you can end up in, seem to result in the same asset being accounted for by two different entities. And this isn't just us thinking there should be reciprocal accounting, it just seems very strange that the very same asset would be in two balance sheets. So we would simply see straightforward capitalization of leases in the traditional manner as being a much preferred approach. Having said all of that, we are very strongly in favour of the board going forward on an asset and liability approach. Absolutely the most important part of our reaction, I think, is support for what you're doing. So don't let the commentary on the dual approach overwhelm that comment.
Okay. We support the objective of the project to improve the financial information about lease transaction. The first thing is whether there are two types of leases. Clearly, the lesser accounting, we support strongly there are two types of leases. But going back to receipts, there are slight different types of lease may exist. Since you have the you take the right of use approach, it may be difficult to find the clear line. But what I'm gonna say from now is matter about materiality or cost of, well, cost and benefit. Clearly, the proposed right of use model would require the lessee to capture the transfer of control to use the asset, even if the lease term is relatively short. In that sense, you think the right of use model is one model. The exception of short-term lease is not theoretically provided. Putting that whether there are two types of leases existing or not, we have to consider the cost of benefit consideration more. The short-term lease is limited to very the 1 year, less than 1 year lease. However, for lease whose lease term is relatively short compared to the economic useful life of the underlying asset, so we think that it is unclear whether the benefit to users would outweigh the cost resulting from applying the right of use model. So in Japan, our stakeholders' voices strongly oppose the current proposal. One is that at least in Japan, the current existing IS 17 is operating well, except for the certain assets such as airplane, ships, and specific areas. So they are opposing the heavy equipped standards like this. And some other stakeholder mentioned that specific quantitative criteria for materiality is required. That idea is very similar with our idea. The cost-benefit line should be found for finding the exit of this project.
So, Igor, from what I talking to the Japanese lease industry on Monday, what I understand is that actually most of the equipment leases are already on the balance sheet because there's not a lot of structuring going on around the 90%.
Equipment lease is categorized as financial lease or operating lease. So their statistics said that with the operating leases on balance, if the all the operating leases on balance based on the note disclosure, that increases 1% of total asset. So they think that's not material, so that's why they don't like, you know, major changes of lease accounting.
What is the view of Japanese investors and analysts? Have they expressed any view?
Analysts express a view that usual reaction that much larger the balance sheet is okay, but this is not my review, but somebody said about 30% of analysts strongly support increase of asset recognition, or that means that 70% don't care as a status quo.
Roger?
Well, we were talking yesterday about stocks and flows, and reflecting that there's various things that users are interested in. They're interested in operational capability, for example. They're also interested in financial flexibility. And you have to make a choice about how you're going to, what you're going to reflect in the accounts. And I think you've made the right choice, effectively by focusing on the liability and what the unavoidable liability is, so that people, so that users understand what the long-term commitments are, which can't be avoided. And I talked about retail chains in the UK going bankrupt yesterday, and this is information which would be very useful. So I think we support the thrust of the project, and we agree the right of use model will work in that. We don't, however, support the complexity that's currently there, particularly with the dual model on both sides. We think that flips the cost-benefit equation. So we don't actually support the exposure draft as is at the moment, but we could support a simpler model.
What's the fee? If we would go back to the original proposal, then you could support it.
Yeah, a single model approach. We think that conceptually there aren't really any arguments for the dual approach. In fact, if you were to follow the logical conclusion, you would actually take property leases off the balance sheet, which is not an outcome we would favour, because we don't actually think that would give useful information. But we don't actually, we think this is a pragmatic solution, searching for a conceptual foundation.
That does sometime happen.
Okay. In general, the group actually is having support for the AOS Institute Group is having support for the dual model. I think it's fair to say that a lot of the members are pleased to see the application of the control concept, which is similar to the revenue in IFRS 10. Two specific concerns brought up at the discussion stage. One is on the capacity portion of an asset, which is less than substantial of the asset capacity cannot be identified as asset. That notion, I think one of the member would like the board to revisit that, particularly in the context of fiber optic cable. Sometimes you don't have the portion that make up of the majority asset, but still is under lease sort of arrangement. So that is a particular concern brought up, and also on the area that where the entire contract could be treated as a single lease contract, and the suggestion is to have more clarity on the requirement using primary component as determinant. That one needs more guidance. But I also like to bring Hong Kong's will to the table. Our local constituents from Hong Kong, however, is having grave concern on the dual asset model, and basically because of two will. One is that initially when the project started off, it was based on the presumption that it would be a single asset, single model, and we see it, the adoption of the dual model is just a compromise to try to fit in the right of use model onto the type B leases, which I think most of our concern is coming on the type B leases, which actually doesn't fit into the asset and liability model that we don't believe that is the case. We think that quite a number of our members of our work group actually thinks that the 17, the operating lease is good enough for depicting that kind of transactions.
So Clement, I'm a bit confused now. I understand your constituents do not like the dual model.
Yep.
But does it mean they just want things as they are, or would they like us to go back to the original proposal?
No, asset and liability approach is fine.
Okay.
But only that the present suggestion for the type B leases is not very satisfactory.
By the way, for those who do not like the dual, would prefer single model, you would like the model with full amortization then, or?
2010 model.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, is your recommendation that we have in the exposure draft the balance sheet's appropriate, but the split in the income statement should not be type A, type B, it should be IAS 17?
Primarily, the amortization model for the type B definitely is under a lot of question.
I think what some people are saying is that if you're going to divide type A and type B, 17 might be the basis for doing that. I think that might be where the 17 comment is
on
coming.
On what basis? For what reason?
Well, the same way in which you would divide whether you've got a finance lease or an operating lease, they think they're familiar with that, and it might be more comfortable if you're going
to
have an A versus
context,
a B. Right. If you're in that camp.
Yeah.
But this was a Hong Kong comment. You said the overall group.
No, the overall group.
We're in favour of the dual model.
On the balance.
But in Hong Kong, there's a stronger movement against the dual model.
That's correct.
But would leave the majority of property leases with a type B earnings picture.
Wouldn't you leave the real estate portion off balance sheet?
I think he's saying all leases are on balance sheet, but the income statement impact would look like it is today under IAS 17. I think that's what he's saying. So the balance sheet is what the exposure draft says. The income statement is today.
What you are saying, Roger.
Yes, I mean, basically, I'm happy getting the liabilities for those long-term property leases on the balance sheet. I do not want a dual income statement model.
Yeah, but that can be resolved in two ways.
He's saying something different.
Because I think Roger's saying a single model.
Roger's saying the 2010 ED, single lessee model.
Yeah.
Clement's saying a dual model, but on the basis of a split based on the 17.
Well, level. if you were to insist on a dual model, we'd prefer Clement's approach. Because people understand that, but the fact that you can't even find a name for type A and type B shows that these things don't exist in nature. Is one of my
what would you call the 17 split then?
Do you have
a name for that?
I'm not. Well, people have a name at the moment. You probably don't want to go back to it, but
we could find a name for
that. The IAS 17 that I've heard, the split, is that what you say is all that the capital leases are in substance purchases, and they aren't considered leases, they're in substance purchases, and then all other leases are on balance sheet in a straight line.
But we all know the real situation. I mean, you go to a certain percentage and then you tip over in one end or another percent and you go in the other direction. And if you take a look on people who are buying equipment, for example, we are giving them then the opportunity of deciding, do I want to have this profile or that profile? So a like transaction will then be accounted for dislike, because a lot of people then choose what model they would like to have. And what we had, what they hammered out in the exposure draft, was to say that most equipment leases would be accounted for the same way. I think that is a very strong thing. I have the problem with the names, I accept that, but I think there's a very strong argument for not going the 17 route.
The users, a lot of the users who are looking at companies that are leasing equipment, very much like, you know, they support the information that they're getting. They do like getting the interest and the amortization. So, you know, and that was a feature of actually a lot of the equity analysis that you talk to. They actually, for the sectors that they're primarily focused on, they like the income statement effect. So the guys who are looking at the heavy intensive equipment companies support the type A accounting.
And the people are looking at the few prepares with heavy capital spending as well.
Yeah, because of that sort of equivalence of the leasing versus the buy decision. Whereas the analysts who are following the sort of the retail sector or the hotel sectors very much support the single lease expense.
A lot of the equity analysts, they divide their analysis into two sections. One is sort of the operating performance, and one is sort of the financial situation of the company, how much debt, etc. And if you take the lease expense into the operating, which would be then for most equipment, possibly if we go the 17 route, that would be charged then into the operating performance. While if we go the ED way, it would be split, so you get the right use consumption of capital in the operating, and you get the financial expense among the financial expenses, which means that the analyst would get then the right performance. And some preparers are positive to this. It's also positive because they know that there's a higher multiple on the operating performance than on the financial balance. So would we go the 17 route, we would make a much worse base for doing a thorough analysis.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yes, I mean, on this project, representing Europe as a whole is quite a challenge. There is obviously quite a wide diversity of views still. And that is true across the various categories of stakeholders. So it's not, you know, the users on one side and the preparers on the other. Having said that, I think that the position that Roger has expressed is probably not far from being a form of majority view. So there is support for the right of use model applied to a proper population of arrangements. The recommendation to the board, the strong recommendation to the board, is really to work on the cost and the complexity aspects that may have been maybe driven partly for with the maybe an overambitious scope at present. And so, in the deliberations, probably the search for a simpler outcome altogether might be the right objective. Out of the field work that has been performed, I mean, it comes to the fore that 50% of the leases in number are for less than 5 years. And that the one-year exemption would be more or less ineffective. So that's probably some good input into some possible result. Also, the two areas that create the most complexities and probably related costs seem to be the assessment of the lease term. So where the position of the board of taking into account the option is favored, people would like to be able to rely on, you know, the reasonably certain assessment that exists under IS-17 and do it at the outset. And not revisit that, and it seems that it would be more in line with the objective of capturing, which is not necessarily an option to start with, a real option to start with. And that would probably be a gain in understanding, because having in the basis for conclusion that you intend to have the same result, but you built a completely different guidance, I mean, creates a lot of misunderstanding, and the reassessment is complex. The other issue that creates a lot of less complexity but still difficulties is linked to the separation of the of arrangement into different components. And there may be, whilst the definition exactly as Clement said, I mean, the definition of the lease in the way it has been improved, and the reference to the right of use, the right to control the use of the asset has been developed. There may be some further thinking to have about the effect of a certain number of what you could see as being services rendered to the lessee, which in fact are the representation that the lessor keeps the management of the asset and its responsibility. So maybe in a certain number of arrangements, basically what is there is just a purchase of a small capacity of the equipment. I've not so far commented on the dual approach. It's seen as an extra layer of complexity. It's seen as an impediment into the understanding of what the board is intended to do. However, there are also a certain number of people that I would echo Kevin in saying, if this is what you need to have to make the project work, why not? And I should not disemphasize the fact that there are still maybe a minority, but a minority of his opponents to the project.
Anna?
Yes. We agree that some leases are economically different from others, so we agree with the dual model, the two types of accounting. But in relation to the type B lessee accounting, we believe that taking expenses on straight line basis may not reflect the economic substance, because amortization would be taken to profit or loss on would be increasing, and that doesn't show the consumption of economic benefits inherent to the rights of use. So we think that type B lessee accounting should be symmetric with type B lessor accounting, and they should be, have the same measurement and recognition treatment.
Alexandru?
Two comments. The first one is the point that Ian presented regarding separation of reparation and financial expenses, and this point was quite unanimous in the region about the importance to keep operational and financial expenses separated in the income statement. That was very few unanimous thing. The other thing that's quite unanimous, it's to my surprise, was the definition of lease. Can I explain to you why? Because you have a very short definition of lease in paragraph 8 and paragraph 6, and then you put some another characteristics in paragraph 12. And what people request, and this was unanimous in the region, is that to actually put those features on paragraph 12 into the definition of lease, and put more clearly about the definition of lease. The reason is there are a lot of contracts which are going to be changed because of this standard, and they cannot refer to IFRS standard number 2 for the definition of lease. They need to have as robust as possible definition of what the lease means. So because this is a big change.
We're going to talk about the sort of the scope and the definition of the leases, you know, so if you want to elaborate further here.
And the actual proposed definition here that can give you just more robust and including the other points.
Yeah, in our jurisdiction, I think the majority view is that they are supportive of the proposed model, but I think it's more of a reluctant acceptance of the fact that they want leases on balance sheet, and I guess it's a pragmatic approach, even though the dual model is conceptually flawed. There are some minority views which I think want a more purer conceptual basis, and I guess they would be in line with the 2010 ED. The point that I just wanted to raise, and I think it ties in with the conceptual framework project in terms of the definitions of assets, is, you know, it looks like we're going there as to being, you know, assets are a bundle of rights. And so, you know, I sort of think that in a way here, one of the issues that has caused concern in this project is really, if you like, the unit of account. So, you know, what is the thing that we're trying to reflect on the balance sheet? And so although, yes, it talks about this right of use, on the one hand, one would envisage, no matter whether or not you've got a right to use an asset for 5 years, 55 years, or whatever it is, if that is the right that you have, it is interesting that we're going to end up with a different basis of reflecting the consumption of that right. So we seem to, in a way, perhaps be struggling with looking at, is it simply a right of use, or are we trying to reflect the underlying asset? And I guess our historical accounting models have perhaps gone more to the physical asset being the property or the equipment or whatever it is. But under the conceptual framework, it looks like we're going to saying, well, no, actually an asset, it could be a individual rights, and maybe an item of property, plant and equipment might be a whole bundle of rights, being rights of use, right to sell the item, etc., etc. But, you know, we can see that structures like leases and all sorts of other transactions, they've been taking traditional assets and splitting them up and, you know, selling off the rights or transferring the rights. And I'm just wondering whether or not, now, isn't that what's causing the problem, which I think is where I personally struggle with the dual model, because if we're saying it's, you know, the right that we're reflecting is the right of use, then how do we get some being amortized, you know, or the income statement showing a completely different approach?
Yeah. I mean, and you've put your finger there on the fundamental tension that we are trying to, in the lessee's books, account for right of use, but then we have layered over this consumption principle. And I guess in part that's just simply because the way that the you know, the users use that information is that they are looking at the underlying assets in a lot of cases as well, and they're making comparisons between those people who are leasing and those who are buying. So although we're accounting for this right of use, the underlying asset is still important. But of course that tension undoubtedly sort of manifests itself, I think, most clearly with, you know, those people who are concerned that you have this sort of debt obligation on the balance sheet, and for the type B accounting you don't have the interest expense in the P&L, and that's where it sort of perhaps manifests itself most.
Why isn't the cash flow statement solving your problem? Well, the cash flow statement will show you the amount going out the door. It may not be as level as an operating expense, but will tend to be. Yep. If they really want to see that number, why don't they just look there?
It's interesting to see that further removed the national standards are from London, that they're conceptually pure every time they get
them. It might be so, but I've spent 30 years in lease accounting as a consultant in that area. I've seen every dark corner of this topic.
Linda.
Thank you. So I would characterize where we ended up getting was somewhat underwhelming support. It was interesting to watch the process that stakeholders went through on this project. When the ED first hit, I'm talking about this ED, there was a hue and cry, and had lots of phone calls, lots of discussions at the board level around the flaws with the model. Got to the point where when we tried to have roundtables on the topic, we had to cancel the roundtables for lack of people registering for the roundtables. So as people seem to move their way through this, there seemed to be some acceptance, and I would say also on the part of preparers, that they could live with the approach. Somewhat similar to comments already made, from a board perspective, there is concern that this isn't a conceptually pure model. Okay, there's a view that there's a compromise between the dual model approach, but there was agreement, widespread agreement, that it was better than what we have, and that the proposal represents an improvement. I would say that the biggest concern we continue to hear from preparers, and some from users as well, is that there will be, they're concerned about the interpretation of the term significant economic incentive and the impact that's going to have on defining the lease term. So there is some concern on that. So please be aware of that in terms of your further deliberations. And the other thing from a preparer perspective is they do acknowledge that for those who don't already have it, they're going to have to put in some sort of system to track these and continue to do reassessments as they renew leases. So they do feel that there is a substantial cost to complying with the proposal.
You?
Thank you. I would like to share with you some of the comments from the stakeholders from China, which also reflects our views on the lease accounting. Generally, we support the right of use model, but we disagree with the dual model, dual approach, that is type A and type B lease, because we think the proposed classification of lease, type A, type B, lacks conceptual basis and is more complex. The dual approach of type A and type B may lead to different accounting treatments for similar transactions, and it will reduce the comparability in financial statements. So I think that's a big concern from us and from the stakeholder in China. Generally, also we think maybe the ED still needs further improvements. Here we have some suggestions. It includes two options. The first one, maybe similar to some other comments, that we hope the SB could reconsider the project and take more time and efforts to develop a single model for lease accounting. That's option one. The second option is, as we know that the original, one of the major original purpose for this project is to to make improvement for the lessee accounting. I mean, to resolve the off-balance sheet financing issue. So we would suggest that maybe we can just make some minimum revision to the ISS 17, just to require the C to recognize the right and the liability arising from operating leases on the balance sheet. That maybe that's just a minimum revision to these standards. Thank you.
And then leave the income statement as it is in the second option.
I think that's just saying capitalized operating leases.
Yeah. So, but without consequences for the income statement. Or
with the consequences you would normally get from capitalization, so amortization.
So it's basically just 2010.
Front loading.
So we obviously went to this dual model in response to feedback that we'd got about the income statement effects of leases and the observations that a few made about there being a sort of spectrum of economics of leases, and we tried to distinguish at least two types within that spectrum. But there doesn't seem to me, if I've understood the comments you've made today, that there seems to be much support anymore for a need for there to be a dual approach in the income statement. Is that fair? Yes.
Well, I heard.
There were a few.
I think it's very mixed.
Just trying to work it out.
Well, for Canada, they see the okay, not conceptually pure, but
we like the results.
It's an acceptance.
The reason why I'm asking is because, in my understanding from the field work, and we're only partway through it, is that quite a lot of preparers are raising the need to distinguish between the two types of leases is quite a source of complexity. So I'm trying to work out whether people think there is a benefit still from the dual.
My count up of it, I've just done quickly, was one strongly yes for the dual model, four no, and five
could live with it.
Somewhere in between.
When you say you support dual models and the one to symmetrical treatment for the type B, but not fully understand, you know, on balance sheet side or income statement side? Not fully understand.
Yes, we believe that under type B lease, lessee accounting, you capitalize all the nowadays operating leases. So I think maybe we should review the concept of rights of use and some of those operating leases that you pretend to take to the balance sheet should have the same treatment of operating leases that are now they are now treated in IS 17, which is symmetric with the type B lessor accounting proposed.
It's in the profit and loss.
Yes, not in the balance sheet, but the
profit and loss.
I'm still not clear what that means. Don't capitalize type B leases.
Just to help Ian's statistic, we are not in favor of the split between A and B, and we think it adds complexity that is unhelpful. We think that the right of use has a lot of theoretical appeal, but that somehow you shrink from going all the way. And I would briefly take it back to IFRIC 4. I mean, IFRIC 4 has been around for a while, and I always felt, and most of those coming from accounting firms would probably agree to that IFRIC 4 was there, but the application of IFRIC 4 was possibly somewhat limited because people shrank from seeing what they were supposed to see. And or there are a number of contracts out there which could have or should have been treated like lease contracts, but were not necessarily treated as lease contracts. And the step to really go for right of use accounting, specifically for the lessee, is a step where it's change management too and mindset change, which hasn't made it all the way yet.
I mean, in part, Liesl, when we developed IFRIC 4, of course, you know, you talk about people not sort of fully embracing it. I mean, it was because I think we acknowledged at the time that most of the arrangements that it then sort of captured that previously people might not have thought of being leases, of course, ended up being operating leases. So a lot of people just saw it, well, it was just providing additional disclosure about some sort of longer term contractual commitments. But that's a good point. And, you know, we tried to make the point then that IS 17 really was about rights and not the underlying asset, although, of course, that's a little hard to explain in the context of the IS 17 model.
Well, in all the arguments that have been going to and fro over the last years, I would say, people have been flipping between the underlying and the right of use, and between the lessor and the lessee, and it was difficult to see someone arguing all the way along the line of the right of use for the lessee or the other way or whatever, because everyone found something they didn't like and then they flipped to something else.
Well, yeah. But so what is your conclusion, Lisa? Where should we end?
Well, we came up with, because of course, not overwhelming support for everything, sort of compromise which is a pragmatic compromise, that for the time being you should possibly not do that much on the lessor side, which is the first step, because if you follow the argument, don't fix what ain't broken, and the lessor accounting was not that much in the limelight, and for the lessee accounting I think you are closer to something digestible. And in the lessee accounting, go for type A.
One model, not two. Yeah.
And your steps from 2010 to 2013 have eliminated a number of complex areas, but you added others. So on your way to less complex, you've done a sort of halfway house. And we find it good what you did in some parts, but not in others.
So those of you who think we should go to all type A, Francois made a point. I think what Francois said was that she was supportive of type A as long as there was a, quote, an appropriate population, which I view as broaden the one-year scope out. But my question is those of you that are saying it should be one model in type A, do you believe that we should consider broadening the 1 year? And if so, do you think it should be how would we do that? Would it be on year and amount, core, non-core?
Or a combination of
or,
the possible.
Or all the above?
Complexity.
Mm. I think that Pico has to say something about
okay, that. Okay, regarding the two type or one type issues, we have a different opinion about lessor's accounting. Clearly, lessors have two types of leases. Lessor's focus is on the underlying asset. So lessor's accounting is not related to its right of use asset. Right of use asset is only for lessee. So from the point of underlying asset, lessor should think about when they transfer the control or give the risk and rewards of the underlying asset. In that sense, the point they record the revenue is something similar with the point of finance lease, but something plus alpha. So in that sense, lessor's accounting should be different from lessee accounting. Go back to the lessee's accounting. We are not sure whether there are two types of leases, but currently, type B leases for equipment is very limited. So that may be very similar point with short period lease. So if we explore the exemption of off balance, then we don't know whether type B will be remain or not.
So I had you down as a question mark on the dual approach. Is that you're not sure whether you're in favour of it or not?
At this point, clearly there are two types of lease for lessor, but we know that there are two types of solution, like type A and type B, but the type B for equipment lease is so limited, so very close from a short-term lease. So if you want to increase the exemption, type B lease maybe almost eliminate. I don't know.
I think what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that we could do better than the dual model, and if we focused on an appropriate population for type A, the issues of type B goes away. I think that's what he's saying.
Yeah. Sort of just going back to sort of Russ's comments about sort of questions around the scope, perhaps if we stick on the definition of a lease and just touch on that later, but this idea of trying to broaden the exemption that we gave with the 1 year lease, and then perhaps we should move on to lesser accounting. But are there any thoughts in response to what Russ said about broadening the practical expedient?
The way I look at the 1 year expedient is it's completely irrelevant. I've yet to see any 1 year leases that I can think of other than my hire car. So to be 1 year exemption left you with a fairly pure model, so I was happy where you were. You start pushing that limit out to it really meaning something, and you provide a real arbitrage point. And you'll suffer from that.
We all.
I don't support an arbitrary 5 years or 3 years or any other approach to it. I would depend on materiality. If they're immaterial, fine. Let them off the hook.
Well, that's what instinctively appeals to me as more as well, to take out the more nitty-gritty stuff.
And as Henry said, the 1 year took out, you know, this debate about hotel rooms overnight, all that sort of stuff. It just removed the noise.
But I also think we need to do a better job with just the problem about, you know, how people make judgments today about what they capitalise under IAS 16. That type of thinking also applies to your right of use assets as well.
I know there's this sort of practical versus theoretical line in our debate, but I'm very concerned about that. I don't know how many of you have ever found yourself in a position of a failed sale accounting. It's not a nice place to be. So you pass an asset to somebody else in a sale, but you fail the tests about continuing involvement and so on. And you end up accounting for an asset you physically haven't got, have nothing to do with, as if you still held it. That's not so very far removed from the theory of lessor accounting. You don't have the physical asset. You don't even have the right to use the physical asset.
Access information about the asset.
Yes, but you do have a right of return. And we seem to get hung up because that right of return can be the vast percentage of the value of the underlying. So we're really not convinced about the right of use approach once we start jibbing like that. The question I put to the two round tables we had here is, pretend you've got both of these leases, type A and type B, and I think the comment came up before, what arcane description are you going to use to show these two lots of leases in your account? Type A and type B? Really? People say there are two sorts of leases. Really? What are the two sorts? I haven't heard it yet. I've seen an acceptance or a non-acceptance of the right of use model. That's the only thing I can see.
Linda?
So just being specific to Russell's question, one of the things that we did in our outreach is we did work with a few companies around the 1 year question, so I'm really focused on that. And what we found, and it was very limited, was that there was no material difference between whether you scoped out 1 year, 3 years. If you got past three, went to five, it was materially different. So I think we put in our comment letter that we'd suggest that you look at that. But that was based on a limited sample, but it was some work that we tried to do to understand what the impact of the 1 year would be.
Going from one to three might not be so material now, but once you do it, there will be a lot of structuring going on, I'm afraid. Roger?
Well, I agree with Kevin that there aren't actually that many leases just under 1 year as a stable 1 year. You've either got very short-term leases or you've got real leases. I suppose you may have the odd auto lease at that level. Just two comments. Actually, going back to the original Type A, Type B, one of the complexities is you have to actually link your asset with your liability model when you're actually trying to fix your depreciation. And if you have a lot of small leases of that type, that becomes very complicated. Now, I don't have any instant solution to the definitional problem, but what it would be nice to avoid is where you have a lot of relatively low value leases, which when you add them together, you can't really say they're not material, but the actual complexity of doing this accounting is burdensome, and various we're in a public meeting, so various preparers have shared with me some of their problems. You can have an awful lot of these things. They're probably too small to say they're negligible. They add up to a reasonable amount, but it takes a huge amount of bookkeeping to actually maintain them.
And that's those examples, what were they talking about? Can you?
Well, as I say, we're in a public meeting, so perhaps we'll share that offline. But I can give you some examples.
Would those examples be similar to what you'd have with a capitalization threshold in PP&E?
Well, possibly. Except, as I say, you might have a fair number of these things, and it's very hard to say if you add them all up. Yeah, I mean, and you're back into the discussion we had yesterday about materiality and people defaulting to, let's not get criticised. The other issue I'd raise is this default that if you can't split a service contract with a lease contract, it defaults to a lease contract. And I can understand the anti-avoidance motivations for that. But there are some genuine things. Now, in the revenue recognition standards, I understand that you do make some sort of reasonable allocation. And I think it would be easy doing that. You may actually have quite a small lease element rather than just defaulting and saying the whole thing is a lease contract.
Thanks. I also like to respond to a comment made by Gua about whether there's different type of leases for lessee. I think one of the biggest pushback from our jurisdiction is coming from the commercial retailers. They are having thousands of leases for their retail outlets, and to them, it's not a financing arrangement at all to them. And in those scenarios, I think a comment made by Roger just now about the complexity of accounting to try to sort of analyze all the leases on the balance sheet is a big task for them. And secondly, to them is when you look at the lessor, if you're talking about type B leases, you record those as rental income, and to them is on the lessee side. It would make more sense to them to record those as just like any other periodic costs, rather than sort of.
Clement, those were the commercial retailers that went broke in the UK because they couldn't scale back their leases in time.
Yeah.
Those are. It's part of their. It's core of their business model, and it has a huge financing.
It goes to the lack of financial flexibility.
Yeah.
You have a downturn, you can't get out of all of those commitments, and I'm afraid that the analysts are looking for this. You just get the right rental expense, and they have to.
And I really feel very little sympathy for the argument that it's complicated for them to manage that. I mean, it's their business to manage their leases properly, and they should be able to have this information at their fingertips, I would say. Jan?
Well, this with one or two models is of course a complicated thing, and I think on conceptual grounds it can only be one model solution, of course. But I think it's also quite convincing meeting some of the retailers, and retail is the industry that will be mostly affected by this change that we are considering. They have thousands of stores. They are on a 2, 3, 4, 5 year contracts, and they don't think they have really any control over the shopping center. And then you meet the analysts who are analyzing the retail, and they say more or less the same thing. I think when you are into these shopping malls and when you are into high street retailing, I see really the logic for not being conceptual, to have two models. Both investors and preparers would like to see it. And I think that if we then see how can we take away complexity, because I think that is really the concern, at least for me, I think if we are more pronounced on saying that what is building and things like building, I think, for example, that the Taylor Towers and things like that could be considered to be of the same category. It's something which is tied to the ground, it's long-lasting. But we say, basically, if there is not clear indication of something else, it goes into one corner, treated one way. And basically, all other things are going with the A model. I think we will have rather clear situation. This with significant economic incentive, we didn't pronounce that the right way. And we have a number of small things that we can simplify. And I think if we do that, we can live with the two models. The problem is, of course, you would get the dividing line more in the building area if you have a financial lease. And then, of course, that must be treated the right way. But I think we can find, and the team is every day adding on small things for simplifications. And I think the main thing will be this with buildings or not buildings.
So perhaps if we want to make the distinction clearer or more simple, we should probably make it much cruder.
Yeah.
And just say retail one side, all the other stuff the other side. Very roughly said. Way go.
I went to China to attend a few outreach meetings, and of course the views are quite, you know, diverse based on different reasons. But the thing you just mentioned about the preference, the one model, for all change, let's see only, and then Hans asked about why, about income statement, whether there is a concern. There are a few companies that I see their concern, but their observation very similar to our staff's paper presented several times. That is, as long as you require capitalization, the complexity already there. You know, you have to bifurcate service from non-service, and you have to distinguish between the costs from the interest. So complexity already is there. And you straight line are not able to reduce complexity. This is their observation. And secondly, you know, except a few companies like Port and others, and most of them say, you know, the company have, you know, continuous lease transactions, even shopping malls, retailers, and they have different, you know, lease contracts. By the end, if you look at long-termly, there's no sense to use straight line or distinguish between straight line method or others, because the overall expenditures will be equalized by some ways.
Lison, finally on this section, and from Lison we go to Lessor.
Very briefly, to call retail retail, I think it's a bit simplifying things or oversimplifying things. First of all, in shopping malls, you get a lot of head leases where you are supposed to keep going because you are the head lease, and all the smaller ones can sort of turn the switch, but not you as the head lease. And having retail leases of 5 years, I think in some areas of Europe, at least, you're unlikely to get them for 5 years. They're more likely to be 10 or 15 or 20 years. And just switching off retail or not, I think, is, as I said, oversimplifying.
I understand. Okay, let's continue to the...
I mean, we've obviously touched on the lessor accounting already, and I've already heard
some different views here, some sort of saying that effectively we could leave lesser accounting essentially as it is, or that it's, you know, the line that you might want to have for lesser accounting could be different from lessee, and others sort of saying obviously it there should be a sort of symmetry between the two. But before we sort of leave this first section about the overall model, just wanted to make sure, were there any other comments about the lessor accounting that people wanted to raise?
I guess even if you went to a traditional approach to lease accounting for the lessor, there's the question of the residual asset that seems to concern them considerably. I didn't think much of the approach in the ED, but maybe there is an argument for them to be able to revalue the residual amount, so at least their balance sheet looks a little bit more symmetrical. So that's one area I think we maybe could help them.
Was your concern to do with the effectively the deferred profit piece as well? You prefer to just view the residual, but the discounted expected value of it?
I've dealt with too many lessors who actually make more money out of the second and third turns of the asset than they do out of the first, and the approach you've got tends to suggest the first lessee is going to pay for the asset, which is just not economically true. So I'm not sure why I'm accreting a retained interest in an asset that has nothing to do with the first transaction. So they go out and they borrow $100 to invest in the $100 asset. Yeah. Let's say there's $10 worth of value in the first term and $90 left. They're a bit worried about that over time. Well, you know, let's think about revaluing or accounting in value terms for the residual separate from the assets.
So you're actually unhappy with the sort of the accretion model as well? It'd just be the revaluation?
Roger?
I suppose, I mean, the main driver of this project was to fix lessee accounting, and in fact to get to this financial flexibility issue that I was talking about. And you could argue the lessor accounting model is not broken. Everyone seems to understand it. Would it just help to focus on the lessee accounting side in order to get this out?
Any other comments on this?
Okay. Well, thank you. So shall we move on to the second topic? Again, people have already touched on the measurement model, but we'll see if there are any further comments. This was an area where the boards really did try to significantly simplify the proposals in the 2010 ED, for example, on determining the lease term. The optional periods are now only included in the lease term if there's a significant economic incentive to exercise the option. Variable lease payments are generally excluded from the measurement of the lease liability unless they depend on an index or a rate. So we have had quite a lot of feedback on this area. I will just say one thing about the user feedback on this, which actually was quite surprising to me, is that a lot of the users actually generally supported the simplifications that we had made to the measurement model. It seemed that they liked the fact that the numbers would not be as subjective as they would have been under the 2010 ED. So I thought that was quite interesting. So we've got effectively four questions on the measurement, and maybe if you could sort of clarify whether your concern relates to the initial measurement or is it to do with the reassessment question as well in your comments. Are there any further simplifications that we can make, for example?
I don't think it might fit into that category.
No comments?
briefly through Liesl. Very briefly, of course, people struggle with the idea of having to reassess frequently. However, I mean, this is a sort of general belief question, if you lock in things and keep it that way, or if you think you should reassess. And that is, again, the weighing judgment, how precise do you want to be and how simplified do you want to go?
I think in general people are looking for an approach that sort of perhaps has more of a trigger for reassessment rather than having to sort of constantly reassess, and particularly also on the variable lease payments on the index rate. Is that people are reading it that you actually have to literally reassess at every quarter end.
Yeah.
I already mentioned in my first comments what I thought a direction could be for the lease term. I would be interested to see whether there is support for that.
And then could you repeat?
To clearly
three or four years
move back to having options only when they are reasonably certain at the outset of the lease and with no reassessment of the lease term after that. Unless you have a modification of the contract or some other event. Because that seems to be a lot of simplification involved. And seems also to be rather in line with, consistent with the choice that you've made to go for the minimum liability. So
so you're not talking the length of the lease, but the reassessment of the lease. Is that your major point?
I'm talking about another, keeping the wording that you have in I-17 for when you take options into account at the commencement of the lease and not to reassess.
I think part of the problem, I mean, we need to do a better job of explaining what we meant by the significant economic incentive were we to keep that, because we were trying to be slightly more objective about that assessment compared to the reasonably certain or reasonably assured assessment today. That was the idea of saying that had to be something beyond just your intention or you're reasonably certain you're going to renew. There's almost like some external factor that's forcing you, but the overall level was meant to be similar, and we didn't properly convey that, so people have generally seen it as being a sort of a lower threshold from what we intended. So,
but then, I mean, saying that it should be reasonably certain for objective reasons, and
I mean, certainly a lot of people have said, why don't you keep the existing wording?
And so to your point on the reassessment, Francois, so the comment that Henry made about perhaps having triggers that would cause a reassessment, you'd be okay with that idea. So if you'd actually changed your lease term, if you'd actually extended or something, capturing it then, but not just sort of reassessing the likelihood of you making that decision in the future.
Yeah.
Ross?
I was just going to respond to Francois' comment. We had a lengthy discussion at the U.S. roundtables about your exact point. And it was communicated what Henry said, that the terms were designed to get you basically the same answer as reasonably certain or reasonably assured. When we talked about that, people said, well, why don't you use the same words? We then talked to the big four partners that served international, and we said, do you get the same application between reasonably assured and reasonably certain? They said, you do not. So I think what the concept we're going after was a very high threshold, and we need to, in my opinion, determine how to have a high threshold and how to have consistent application, and not have drastic change from the way you analyze it today. And then we'll have to deal with the reassessment.
Equal.
Okay. Regarding this term, we think the reasonably certain criterion in the standard should be retained instead of a significant economic incentive, which might be broadly interpreted. And regarding the in substance fixed payment, it is not clear about whether certain types of sales linked variable lease payments are included. So discussion paper of a conceptual framework is addressing what type of variable consideration would meet the definition of liability. We know that such discussion may affect the treatment of variable lease payment. However, at this point, regarding sales-linked variable lease payments, we are of the view that those payments should be recognized if the entity can reliably estimate the amount.
Clement?
Yeah, we also like to add the support on retaining the term reasonably certain. And as far as the fixed payment, in substance fixed payment is concerned, I think we also are of the opinion that it should be more clearly articulated in the word.
Alexandru?
A very simple one. When you use the wording consume more than a significant portion of economic benefits, to actually differentiate between these, can I read consume more than an immaterial portion? I hope for yes.
It's a similar notion. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there's been a lot of corporate. If we were to keep that line, that distinction.
I'm trying to avoid to ask you from any.
Yeah, no, but a lot of people are looking for, you know, sort of saying it introduces a lot of sort of new terminology that everybody would have to sort of get used to. But people are calling for, could there be some more guidance about some of those new terminology in the lease classification test?
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. Let's move on to topic three now, which concerns scope and separation. This was a topic, particularly the scope aspect of what is a lease, the definition of a lease, that we had a lot of feedback on the 2010 ED, because in that ED we had just carried forward the definition of a lease and that guidance from IFRIC 4, and a lot of people thought that captured arrangements that they thought really were service arrangements and not lease arrangements, and therefore given the fact that the contracts are becoming on the balance sheet now for lessee, felt that we needed to have a look at that and refine the definition. So again, this is an area where we did a lot of work in the redeliberation and also quite an extensive amount of consultation as well. And we came up with the two principles that we got in paragraph 18 of the paper. So they're saying there's two legs to this. The contract has to sort of convey both an identified asset, and the fulfillment of the contract depends on the use of that identified asset, and also that it gives the counterparty, the lessee, the right to control the use of that asset. And that's the leg, that control leg was a bit, I think, where the guidance is where it's new compared to IFRIC 4. And we built off some of the work that the boards had done on control, particularly in revenue recognition from IFRS 10 as well. So, and then the other aspect of the proposals was to provide more guidance about separating a lease component from service components if you had a lease component and a service component. So be interested in your views about our guidance on the definition of a lease, and also the proposals about the separation of lease and non-lease components.
I believe I made my question before to improve the definition, and one way would be to actually add those features into the definition. Something like a contract with fulfillment depends on the use of identifiable asset, and that conveys the ability to direct the use of and derive substantially for the underlying and a non-cancelable period of time. It was surprising to me, but it was absolutely unanimous in the region that everybody would just definition to be stronger, because the definition of use and one for other contracts and things like that.
And did your stakeholders find that there was sufficient guidance then sort of supporting those principles?
The problem they mentioned to me specifically to this standard and this definition that is very hard in some jurisdiction to refer to IFRS statement where the definition of leasing is somewhere there. Or you have to read 10 paragraphs and get a definition.
and where you have to it would be better to refer to a specific definition that people could get translated that to put into contract, put under the on the on thing. No?
Kevin?
we thought the changes from 2010 to this CD were good, and so we support that in relation to the definition of a lease. We got a number of calls for further assistance in terms of clarifying when a service is being provided. The two that were commonly raised were the lease of a shopping centre when there are various associated services involved, you know, cleaning, electricity, security, and all of that. And I think for that and the next one I'm going to mention, people are looking for examples. Our philosophy with examples with AASB is try to provide ones that are clear on the principle, not ones that are at the margin. So you don't have to deal with the murkiest ones to get the idea across. The second example that came up were wet leases for aircraft, trying to distinguish the lease from the other things that are coming with the plane. So more guidance, I think, was the call.
I think in general what we're hearing is people looking for more guidance around the control of the use aspect. And also I think there's been, you know, your point about examples is a good point, Kevin, because there's been, I think, some concern about some of the examples in the ED. People are struggling to understand some of the differences, and I think it's not that they necessarily disagree with the conclusions, it's effectively really being able to pinpoint the distinctions back to the principles and the standard to make sure they fully understand exactly why that one is a lease and that one is not a lease. The coffee making machine.
Yeah.
Okay. Identification of this is one of the points we oppose. For contracts that contain both a lease component and the service component, if there are no observable prices for any of the components in the contract, it is inappropriate for the lessee to always account for such contracts as a single lease component. Treatment would result in always recognizing service component in the contract on the balance sheet. So we suggest that these cases, entity shall be required to determine which component is primary component in the contract.
And do you think that approach would be preferable than for allowing the entity to make an estimate when there's no observable price?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Françoise.
And to follow up on what Iko said and the question raised by Henry, I mean, when you have the premise that if you cannot obtain the benefits from the asset without the services or the goods which are provided by the supplier, and that you couldn't purchase separately, then it seems that the availability of prices should be there, because you know if you're in the capacity of leasing the asset alone without all these services and those goods, then there are prices available. So why isn't that in itself a sign that you have basically an asset which is involved in a package of services making the whole a service more than a lease?
So would you go so far as to say if there aren't observable prices, then it's not really separable into a lease and a service?
I think it logically follows. I mean, if I have in the beginning the choice Then when I make my choice, I probably make it on economic terms and have access to prices to make my decision. So when I've made my decision, all of a sudden I don't have the prices.
Think about some examples. I mean, I can see situations whereby, you know, I've heard some examples whereby there aren't observable prices, but it's more like it's the interlinking of the elements, and therefore people feel that maybe the contract really isn't a lease plus a service, it's just one bundled service arrangement. And I think probably if there's no observable prices, that may be an indicator that you've just got a bundled service. But I'm not sure just because there's no observable prices necessarily it's a bundled arrangement. Because, I mean, you could, you know, just thinking about separation and revenue recognition as well, I mean, there are some arrangements which you'll separate even though the things aren't sort of available separately.
Well, but I think it's different because in the revenue recognition arrangement, basically, you want to separate in order to recognize your revenue as you perform. Mm. And the fact that, and I would expect that somebody who sells out one of those bundles, and if they, what they do is selling those bundles, and there is no observable price for the repurchase, but they would, of course, from a revenue recognition perspective, be able to separate the components because that would necessarily entail some economics for them internally. So to me, there is no contradiction.
Yeah.
It's just that this is not offered on the market.
I mean, and the other one that has resonated with me as well, Francois, is looking at this from the lessor's perspective, is where you get some people who are sort of leasing equipment, or let's say under RED, they would have to view it as being a lease that's a type A lease of equipment plus a service. But the services are very significant. They're fairly, you know, integral, if you like, to the overall service offering, and there they really struggle with the separation in terms of the pattern on revenue recognition, sort of essentially getting the lease income recognized up front and then having interest income and then the revenue from the services over time. They just view that they are, you know, that a revenue recognition pattern consistently over time they feel would be a much better depiction of or representation of the economics of their arrangement. So understand your point, yeah.
It seems to be consistent.
I think you do need to be careful of rolling the right of use and executory contract idea together.
Mm.
I understand the bundle, you know, could be viewed as an asset and a liability, but we've tried to make a distinction there. And if you don't make that distinction, then you can get contracts with a very little right of use and a lot of executory contract that you might wrap up into lease accounting. And I don't think you want to go there.
That was my point earlier, that the default is to a lease. And actually, often the asset might be pretty minor in relation to the overall services provided.
And so some people are calling for sort of saying allow estimates so that you can make a separation as a lessee where the ED currently precludes it. On the other hand, some preparers have sort of said in the workshops that, you know, that they actually don't want to separate even when the ED would sort of require them to do it, and they would be happy just to treat the whole thing as a bundled arrangement and capitalise the whole lot. So there are quite mixed views about how to deal with this problem.
Would they be happy, or would they consider that it's not as bad?
I'm not sure I could fully answer that. I think in part, Francois, it's a sort of cost complexity issue about having to do the separation.
Happiness in the world of accounting is a very irrelevant term. Kim?
Henry, just to go back to that contract for the coffee services, I mean, the example that's given, you know, it's a 2-year contract. I mean, what happens? I mean, does the duration matter? I mean, and I suppose the question there would be is, you know, if you think about some of these coffee machines that one can buy, you can only use the supplier's product. So are you economically in any different position if you have this contract for 2 years, which you can only use with the supplier's product, versus buying a coffee machine outright, which you can again only use with the supplier's? Are we saying we're going to end up with a different answer?
Well, I think what the coffee machine example was trying to illustrate was to sort of say that if essentially this component that you're trying to evaluate whether or not it's a lease, essentially doesn't give you, if you like, any sort of standalone value as the lessee, because it relies solely on sort of subsequent services that are only provided by the lessor, then essentially it was kind of trying to be consistent with the revenue recognition thinking on separation, and therefore sort of saying it really doesn't constitute a standalone component, and therefore you've not really got the right to control anything, any economic benefits, and therefore essentially you've just got a service arrangement. I mean, that's what it was really trying to get at. But people have raised lots of questions about, how does that compare and contrast with the medical equipment example, where it is separated, and it's that the distinction is in the one, you really haven't got something with a sort of like a standalone notion, whereas in the other you have.
But then, if we do follow that through to somebody who has legally bought the coffee machine outright,
yes,
are they not economically in the same position? That again, are we then going to say, well, there's no standalone value, or is the distinction there that they have the right to sell the coffee machine to somebody else?
I think that's the point, is that they have got something, because clearly they could sell it to somebody else, because presumably somebody else must be able to get the consumables on a standalone basis, otherwise they wouldn't purchase it.
I suppose it kind of goes back to the whole bundle of rights. I suppose if you legally buy something outright, you've got the right to sell it. Here you just simply have the right to use it. And yeah,
that's right. I think the boards were concerned that if our definition of a lease would just capture essentially, if you like, assets that are just a sort of means of delivering a service. They are just the dumb box, if you like, that's required. Think about sort of tracking equipment in vans as well. I think the boards were concerned that, that would cause the definition to be too broad, and that wasn't particularly a useful way of viewing those transactions.
Okay. I suppose the final question is the question that has been surfacing time and again during our discussions.
The question of disclosure.
First we have a question.
Go ahead. The last topic is really just to get any views about the disclosure proposals as a fairly comprehensive disclosure package in the ED, and also the transition methodology, because essentially that is a retrospective approach, even though there's sort of various reliefs and modifications of that, but philosophically it's a retrospective transition approach. So are there any comments on the disclosure package or the transition?
Just to repeat what I said yesterday, I think you really should ask yourself what is different about a lease from the elements that you're using in lease accounting that are already represented in some part of IFRS. So why are we topically adding stuff on all the time here when we might depend on the intangible standard or the 16 or 37 or whatever? What is really different about a lease that you need to know? Not tell us everything about leases.
Well, I think we feel that the disclosures at the moment are fairly onerous. On transition, clearly, I suppose smaller companies applying IFRS may well get into covenant type issues. And I think there could be, I'm not sure they've even focused on this yet, but as these liabilities are debt, they're likely to have to go back in many cases to their banks and renegotiate their covenant, their lending facilities, and I don't think this is going to go down very well. So I'm not sure what the solution is, because clearly you can't just go to recognising future leases in this way and recognising past leases in a different way. Perhaps the solution is an extended implementation period.
Is this what you hear in the IT?
There's certainly a lot of the preparer workshops have surfaced the issue about saying that you know, due to the system changes, but also, as you note, the sort of the covenant issue as well, that the standard would require, you know, a reasonably long lead time. It's interesting that you don't really think you could do it on a prospective basis.
Well, going back to this retail store example, you're going to spend the next 10 years not having this information. Well,
and I agree with that. One thing that has surfaced, though, or as a suggestion, which I think is definitely worth looking at, but it would still require reasonably long lead time, is to go more to sort of a cumulative catch-up approach. At the start, you know, let's say we make this effective, let's say 2017, so you don't sort of restate the comparators and you just do a one-time cumulative catch-up adjustment. And I guess, you know, since the board's actually decided to introduce that in revenue recognition after the exposure period, that's certainly worth looking at.
Yeah, I'd be concerned about not allowing restatements, because change of accounting policy often is allowed under covenant, if you know what I mean. But I mean, one of what smaller companies' problems about renegotiating covenants with banks is that you always end up paying more. You know, you have to pay another 50 basis points or whatever to get this change, even though economically you're in no different position before. When we consulted on introducing IFRS to SMEs into the UK and suggested planning revaluations, that was probably the biggest amount of opposition, because a huge number of companies said, well, you know, our bank covenants are based on our asset value, which includes revaluations. If you make us delete these revaluations, we're all going to have to renegotiate our bank covenants. Banks are itching for a reason to say, either we don't want to extend it to you at all, or we're going to charge you a lot more money. So I think this is a practical issue, and to me, the only real way is a long lead time.
Clement?
Yeah, just a clear majority of view on the disclosure is being, they suggest disclosure is being excessive, and in particular, you know, the reconciliations of the required reconciliations are necessary detailed. And from the cost benefit angle, one actually asks about, you know, the usefulness of having all this narrative information on the nature of lease arrangements, which are required at the end, by the present draft. Is it really, you know, beneficial to the users?
You?
Okay, thank you. For the transition and disclosure, we would like to see more simplifications in these standards. For the transition, our suggestion would be, maybe we hope the standards can allow the prospective approach. For the disclosure, we'd like to see more simplifications, especially for the situation. For example, when the entity is both a lessee and a lessor, too much detailed information will be a big burden for the entity. So that's our opinion on the transition and disclosure. In addition, we have some detailed comments on the specific requirements in the ED. I think those were included in our comment letter submitted to SB, so I don't want to repeat them here. So but we do hope that the board can consider, for example, the for the residual assets, for the day one gains, or for type A, for the lessor accounting, or something like that.
Just going back to your point about transition, when you say prospective, you do mean to just contracts entered into after the effective dates? Because I think some then concerned about the lack of comparability on a go-forward basis.
It's very difficult and costly for the entity to use the retrospective approach for the old contracts.
Even if the accounting's really only on a go-forward basis, so you did a catch-up adjustment and then only really had to do the accounting going forward.
think maybe we hope just to use the new standards on the newly signed contracts.
Okay, well, I think that leaves the last question, which is, do you have any suggestions for simplification without upsetting the model? I think this is a question that has been surfacing during the discussions. What serves from the discussions is that there is in itself broad support for bringing the leases to the balance sheet. After that, it becomes more complicated. Nobody completely in love with, conceptually, with the dual model that we have developed, but many that accept it as a practical way out. Some would like to see a pure model, and I think there is a higher tolerance of accepting a pure model if we find ways to make it more simple, perhaps looking at the scope of the proposal. I think these are the tastes that we have in front of us, and we'll have to make some difficult decisions probably. So that's nothing new. You've given us a lot of food for thought, I would like to thank you for that. Jan, is there anything you would like to add? No? Okay, very good. Let's have a break till 11:15, and then we resume with Macrohead.